Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Spring is here. The days are longer. The temperature is warming and green shoots are appearing from trees, shrubs, and the soil. Whether you're walking along a wooded trail, a path to the beach, or at the edge of a playing field, you're likely seeing many edible species of plants. Russ Cohen has been gathering, eating, and teaching people about wild edible plants for decades. He's also the author of Wild Plants I Have Known and Eaten. Russ Cohen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So you have been, as you can, nibbling on nature for a long time. What got you interested in edible plants? And do you actually remember the first things you foraged and ate?
Oh, sure. So this was at Weston High School outside of Boston. When I was a sophomore, I took a mini course called Edible Botany that the high school biology department offered. And so we learned about 24 species of plants that grew around the high school grounds. And cattail was one of them, and wintercress and sheep sorrel and dandelions, daisies, stuff like that. Just grew right along the paths at the high school.
And so what did you eat first?
Oh, probably the daisies. But spring is a good time to look for leafy greens. So that's when the class was. So we learned a lot of those.
So now how do you define the term native?
Native. Okay, so a native plant is one that was here for thousands of years and co-evolved with our ecology, our local insects and things like that. So they're in ecological balance with plants and animals of this region. They've developed ecosystems and places where they grow in association with other plants, so they form plant communities and stuff like that. So they've had a long time for to be in equilibrium with the other organisms that are native to this area.
You retired from your professional career, which included positions at various environmental and conservancy groups on the Mass Department of Fish and Game. How did these jobs complement your passion for edible natives?
All right. So when I was out doing my job, which is working on rivers, I would go all over the state. And most of it was meetings. It wasn't actually standing in river and waders or anything. But after my official work is done, I'd be out there with my foraging basket, just gathering whatever happened to be in season at the time. So it was the job was a good complement to my passion and avocation.
You use the term, as we said, nibbling on nature, and nibbling implies small amounts.
Right.
So are you concerned about people taking too much of the native species?
Well, it depends what the plant is. We've got some delicious edible weeds and invasive species out there, including Japanese knotweed, which is lining the roads in Woods Hole.
Lots of places.
Right. Yeah. And but you've got black locust, which is considered an invasive species, and Dame's rocket, and then just your normal weeds like chicory and burdock and stuff like that. And those are very common. And so
you can take as much as you
want.
That's
right.
Yeah.
That's right. But then when it comes to the native plants, these plants have important roles in the ecosystem, and animals rely upon them for food and some other important portion of their life cycle. So I encourage people to use some forbearance and restraint when gathering native plants from the wild, just to make sure they don't upset the ecological balance in any way.
Yeah, you also have this idea, which I love, which is, you know, as you're pulling out some of these invasives, or you see a spot that pull that out and put in a native plant.
Right.
And if we all are doing that,
it's a simple thing a homeowner could do. Just do a one-for-one swap, is just pop out an invasive honeysuckle or multiflora rose and just pop in a native plant.
Do you have rules or guidelines for gathering native and non-native species for consumption?
Well, in terms of respecting nature and respecting the impact of foraging, yes, there's things I teach in my classes about that. For example, berry picking, nut gathering, and mushroom hunting, those are relatively benign foraging activities because all you're doing is picking the seed or the spore dispersal of the portion of the organism, and there's often a lot of those around. If you gather some, it's usually not that big a deal. But if you're actually digging plants up to harvest them or stripping all the flowers, all the leaves off plants to harvest them, you can imagine it could be a lot more traumatic for the plant.
Yeah. So we were sipping on some tea this morning that
right,
you brought.
Right.
And I have to say, I was really surprised. You have this jar. It's full of twigs, and on the top, it says birch twig tea. So basically, this is water which you put all these twigs in here, right? And as I brought it up to my nose, I smelled, it smells a little bit like root beer, but it has this really lovely taste. It's almost like wintergreen, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually oil of wintergreen that is in the inner bark of black or yellow birch trees. It's the exact same chemical that's in the diminutive wintergreen plants, the very familiar ground cover that's all over the Cape and Islands. And so you could also make this same beverage from those leaves as well.
Is there a you know, do you need a certain number of twigs? I mean, how do you?
I just do it by feel. Mm-hmm. You don't need a certain number. You'll see in the jar in front of you that there's a lot of twigs in there because mm-hmm. I like to have a strong flavor tea. But you could just put a few in and get a mild flavor would be fine.
Yeah, and so you can watch like how the color. I mean, the longer it sits, does it absorb more? Is that
in the case of black and yellow birch, you just peel the twigs in and put the peeled twigs and the peelings in a jar full of water. Let it sit around for an hour at room temperature. So you don't want to heat it mm-hmm. because oil of wintergreen is actually volatile. It's driven off by heat. So if you, let's say, made tea the traditional way with the boiling water from the kettle, your kitchen would smell great, but there'd be no flavor left in your teacup.
Interesting. Oh, isn't that interesting? Well, it's very flavorful. Thanks for bringing
it. Oh, sure.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. We're going to talk about all kinds of interesting plants, and there's more samples to be had. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You keep a calendar for what to look for and
yes.
when. So what's on your calendar for April and May?
Well, things are just getting started now. So the root crops were here all through the fall into the winter. And now that the ground isn't frozen anymore, so there's things like groundnut, for example, which is a plant the Native Americans, it was a very important part of their diet, and it's still around, and they're still eating it. And the Pilgrims found out about it from the Native Americans. And so that's a root that's available year-round. And then there's also Jerusalem artichoke, which is a plant that is originally native to the Midwest, but it was here in 1620, so Ooh. Some people feel that it ought to be considered a native plant. And it's here because our Eastern indigenous peoples traded for it, as we had quahog shells and other things that appealed to the Midwestern tribes, and we got these Jerusalem artichoke tubers in return. And so in places where there are native patches of Jerusalem artichoke tubers, it's very likely that those patches descended from the original patches that were established by Native Americans.
Okay, it's blowing me away that you know this. So 1620.
Right, yeah,
so
sure.
How, I mean, have you been spending like years on research of how these plants got here? With, I mean, obviously the average person isn't going to know that. You know, that this plant was here in 1620.
Right. Right. Well, this is a subject that's been of immense interest to me for a long, long time. So the more I do it, the more I learn and the more information I'm able to share with people. So
that is fascinating. So what else is on the calendar?
So the very beginning green things will begin to show now. So, for example, daylilies. Daylilies have five edible parts to them, with one caveat is there is a certain small segment of the population where daylilies doesn't agree with their digestive systems mm-hmm. and they may have loose bowel movement afterwards. Mm-hmm. But for most people, they can eat it fine. It's actually dried daylily flowers are a standard ingredient in the two Chinese dishes, mushu and hot and sour soup. Mm-hmm. So if you eat those without a problem, you'll probably be okay.
You know what's interesting about that? I had somebody actually bring, we had a potluck thing, and somebody mm-hmm. brought the daylily. I can't remember what they stuffed the flower with. They had stuffed the flower. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait, you can eat those flowers? Mm. And they were really quite good. I was
yes.
so surprised.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Lots of things you can do with all of these things. Well,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you can eat them just plain,
right.
but you can, as we can see around
right.
here.
Right. So, yeah. So before we got on the air, you mentioned stinging nettle. And you,
yes.
Were...
in your book. In your book, I think it's one of the first things you talk
it
about.
It is the first chapter yeah. because it's one of the earliest available foraging opportunities out there.
Yeah. Stinging nettle. Bad for your outside, good for your inside is the name of this. And I was like, oh my gosh, you can eat stinging nettle?
Yeah, it's really good. Actually, the sting itself is actually good for you, not in the raw state, of course, but when you steam the plants, which I recommend that everybody do before you eat it, it converts that chemical that causes the sting in the raw state into a protein. So it makes the plants about 7% protein, which is a pretty high number for
That's
a leafy
amazing.
Green vegetable.
Yeah. And what do they taste like?
Well, a lot of the books, well, you know how all these wild meats are supposed to taste like chicken, like rattlesnake meat tastes like
right.
chicken,
Everything
frog
tastes
legs
like
taste like
chicken.
Well, a lot of wild plants are supposed to taste like spinach, mm-hmm. and some do, but I find the steamed stinging nettle greens taste more like split peas to me.
Split peas,
yeah.
Interesting. All right, and then, of course, what are the little fiddleheads people look for in the spring, too?
Right, so those... The main one that people look for is the ostrich fern, but it's not common at all on Cape Cod because you don't really have the right kind of habitat for it here. It likes an alluvial floodplain soil, so it likes a siltier soil than is common on Cape Cod. So there is a bracken fern that also grows in the Cape that's edible, but it's actually They found out relatively recently that if you eat a lot of it over a prolonged period of time, you might have an elevated incidence of bladder and or stomach cancer.
Oh, not good.
So I've eaten it. It tastes good, but I wouldn't recommend that anybody make it a staple of their diet.
So what would else would be on your calendar for April and May that would be on the Cape and Islands?
So some of the early greens coming out would be chickweed, for example. That starts to show up very soon, and it's a really common garden weed, so I would pretty much guarantee that anybody that grows vegetables that would have chickweed, and you can eat it raw, just right out of the ground. The stems taste like raw corn. The leaves are quite mild. You can use it as a sprout substitute in a sandwich or a lettuce substitute in a salad.
And before we go away from the stinging nettles, they're around pretty much pretty soon, mid-April, right? So
yes, so
we could find them now if we wanted to try that.
I would say in the next week or two, they'll start to show up. And I'm harvesting them when they're only about 6 inches tall. And I know how to do this with without wearing gloves. But
wear gloves.
Probably a good idea for novices to do that. So you grab the top part of the plant, just the top cluster of leaves, and you just prune that off and just keep doing that with all the plants in the nettle patch. And you're not harming the plants at all. And then just bring those home, wash them off, throw them in a pot with more or less just the water that's clinging to them from the washing process, and steam them for about 5 minutes. And then they're done, and you could eat them just plain. But I like to incorporate them into different dishes. So you'll see in my book, I've got a recipe for cream of stinging nettle soup, which sounds like something they might have made in the old Addams Family TV show. But it's quite good. And also wild green spanakopita, the Greek spinach pie with the phyllo dough and the feta cheese. The steamed nettle greens make a really good filling for that dish.
How did you discover all these recipes? Just trial and error?
Some of that is true. For most of these wild ingredients, it's pretty easy to analogize to their cultivated counterparts. So you can take a recipe that is a conventional recipe, and with a little bit of tweaking, you can make it work for a wild food. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Japanese knotweed that most people know of because it's a really hated invasive plant and it is very ecologically disruptive. Well, it's related to rhubarb and it tastes like rhubarb. And so I pick a lot of it every spring and I make baked goods from it, including in front of you.
Yes. What is, so this right, is the so, one that's the knotweed?
Right. So that's the sour cream knotweed crumb cake.
I'm trying it. Mmm. That's good.
Thank you. Yeah. So
and
that's
what a great use for Japanese knotweed.
Right. So I started with a rhubarb recipe and just adapted a little bit to work for the knotweed. So knotweed isn't in season yet. So I made that last year and I pulled it out of my freezer.
Oh,
right.
Wow. Yeah. That's right. Oh, it freezes very nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Wow. All right. So another one, pokeweed is one plant that is edible at certain times of the year and poisonous at others. So what do we need to know about harvesting and eating pokeweed?
Okay. So I have to tell a story that years ago, I was leading a walk and we came upon a patch of pokeweed and I started talking about it and I mentioned that it had poisonous parts. And there was a woman on the walk who was taking these very diligent notes. And when I mentioned the fact that pokeweed had a poisonous part, I saw her go,
cross it off.
She said, okay, I'm not going to do that.
Well, that makes it sound scary, right?
You know, I understand and respect that instinct, but I just want to reassure people that we eat plants with poisonous parts all the time. And the most well-known one is a potato. The only safely edible part of potato is a white potato or, you know, blue, one of the heirloom varieties, but not a green potato because then it has the solanine in it, which is a poison, which is also in the foliage and the berries. And so the only edible part of potato is the actual potato tuber.
Yeah.
And so we eat potatoes even though it has poisonous parts.
Yeah. And I was mentioning before we went on the air, we had a listener a few years ago who prepared some of that pokeweed for us and brought it in. It was delicious.
Right.
No, I think it was just steamed with maybe a little butter on it or something. Maybe it was vinegar.
So pokeweed won't be out in April. It usually doesn't come out until like mid to late May, so more like the latter half of spring. And let me just tell you a story that has to do with Nantucket that's in my book. So years ago, my wife and I were visiting some friends in Nantucket over Memorial Day weekend. And as we're riding our bikes out from the ferry to where our friends lived, we were on a new section of bike path that had just been constructed, and pokeweed loves disturbed habitat, and so there was pokeweed shoots coming up all next to the bike path. So we picked a shopping bag full of these pokeweed shoots, and we brought them to our friend's house. And our friends were busy opening up their cottage and looking after their children over the weekend. So my wife and I did most of the cooking. So on one day, we made pokeweed frittata for breakfast, cream of pokeweed soup for lunch, and pasta primavera with pokeweed for supper. And it was delicious all those ways, and nobody got tired of it.
Lots of things you can do with pokeweed. So when is it not good to? When is it? When
oh,
do you,
you
get
want
to
harvest just the young shoots when they first come out, and this is in mid to late May when they're about 4 to 8 inches tall. That's mm-hmm. the safe range. Make sure you don't get any of the root, because the root always has a toxin in it called phytolacin, which mm-hmm. is a purgative. So in very minute amounts, it might have a therapeutic use, but you don't want to eat too much of it.
So basically, cut it. Don't pull it out. Just like
that's
snip
right.
it.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. All right. 866-999-4626 is our number for your comments, questions, or maybe you have some stories about wild foraging. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Russ Cohen, who has been gathering, eating, and teaching people about wild edible plants for decades. He's also the author of Wild Plants I Have Known and Eaten. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Milkweed is another edible species you include in the book. So when is milkweed at its best for eating, and what parts would you
right,
actually
so
eat?
Right, so the subtitle of my milkweed chapter in my book is A Procrastinating Forager's Dream Food, because it has at least 4 edible stages, and they happen chronologically in succession. So if you mess up and miss a stage, you can just wait a while until the next edible stage develops. So that's another plant like pokeweed that takes a while to show up. And actually, I'm glad you brought up milkweed right after pokeweed, because I should absolutely say in both cases, you absolutely have to cook them. They're mm-hmm. not safe to eat raw.
Okay.
So, and I use the exact same cooking method for milkweed and pokeweed. And as I get a pot of water boiling in the stove, drop the milkweed or pokeweed in and boil it for 7 minutes. And then that's a safe amount of cooking. And they won't shrink or get mushy on you even after all that boiling. So the young milkweed shoots are edible. The leaves off the slightly older shoots are edible. The flower buds are edible when they're in a nice tight green cluster like broccoli florets. And then the pods are edible when they're about an inch long and nice and firm to the touch. So you boil them for 7 minutes and then they're edible.
And you just eat them plain?
You can, and they're also fun to incorporate in different dishes. So in my book, I've got a recipe called milkweed egg puff, which is like a cross between a souffle and a casserole, and the milkweed buds work really well in that.
What do they taste like?
Well, the texture is like broccoli, but it really has its own unique flavor. It's a very pleasant flavor.
Right.
So milkweed's yummy. But before we go on to anything else, let me mention, so milkweed is a native species, and the common milkweed, which is the one that's edible by people, is one of the species the monarch butterflies to
right.
seek out to lay their eggs on. And there's other milkweed species, too, that they'll use that we can't eat. But anyway. And so it's really important to make sure that we have lots of milkweed available for the butterflies to find and lay their eggs on mm-hmm. and so on. So this is a plant I'm actively propagating myself and encouraging other people to grow to make sure there's lots around.
Yeah. And that's something that you propagate lots of different plants and give
yes.
most of them away, right?
Yes. So since I retired from my day job in 2015, I've taken on the role of Johnny Appleseed for native edible species, and I've set up a nursery near where I live out in Weston, where I'm propagating over 1,000 plants of, I'd say, about 60 different species. There's actually more than 170 species that are native to the Zico region that are edible by people. So I've taken on about 60 of those species and propagating a lot of them from seed that I gathered myself, and then I'm working on arrangements with land trusts and Mass Audubon and nature centers and tribal groups and organic farms and other places like that to plant plants in my nursery
wow.
in appropriate places in their properties.
Yeah. Now, spreading dogbane is a species that looks similar to milkweed,
yes.
but it's poisonous. So
yes.
how do you tell the difference between the two?
So when milkweed shoots are out, they bear a superficial resemblance to spreading dogbane. And if you're nervous about mixing the two up, you can just skip the milkweed shoot part of the edible portion of the plant and wait for the flower buds to come out. Because when milkweed flower buds form on the plant, milkweed has a single stalk and spreading dogbane spreads. So it actually branches mm-hmm. out near the top. So at that point, the plants are easily distinguishable.
What are the months of the year with the greatest number of edible species available, and what are the leanest months? Obviously, winter would be lean, right?
Yes, relatively lean, yes. I would say that May and June and September are probably the best, and then July and August and October would come in next.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Janet is giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet. Janet, are you there? Okay, I guess we lost Janet. Janet, you can give us a call back. So you have been keeping this calendar long enough to see changes that could be maybe attributed to warming climate. What are you seeing?
Well, it's possible. I did start keeping records in the early 1990s, and so I've kept track of that. And yes, it seems like in some cases, maybe some, you know, for example, shagbark hickories, which I used to gather in October, now I'm picking them earlier, more like the beginning, the middle of September, I'll start picking those. And so at least for humans, we're pretty resilient. So if wild food is available a week earlier than it used to be before, we can just go out a week earlier and pick it, you know. Yeah. For migrating birds that have schedules that are, you know, where they need to, you know.
Yeah, they can't come a week early, right?
Right, right. And so the timing there could be problematic for them.
All right, since you mentioned the shagbark, you brought some toasted shagbark hickory nuts.
Right.
I'd never even heard of these before.
Yeah, so
they
it's a species.
They are good.
Well, thank you. It's a species that isn't that common in the Cape and the Islands. There's a few of them.
I wish they were.
But but if you go north and west of Boston, like Essex County, Mass, Middlesex County, where I'm from, Worcester County, or Windham County in Connecticut, actually most of Connecticut has lots of these shagbark hickory trees. And it's my number one favorite wild edible out of everything that's out there.
It's delicious.
And it's so good that it's the plant that got me really started in this Johnny Appleseed kick. So I gather thousands of shagbark hickory nuts every year, and I will save many of those nuts for propagating it to new trees, which I'll do myself or pass along to other people to do.
Yeah. And you make a shagbark hickory pie.
Right.
That you say everyone loves. There's never been anybody who says, I don't like this.
Well, what they do is they say, I like this better than pecan pie.
Yeah, I could see why. Yeah. Just tasting the nuts, I could see why that would be the case. All right. Janet is back. Janet from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Hi. I got cut off somehow. Oh. Everything went blank.
Well, I'm glad you called back.
Yeah. I have a lot of sassafras on my property. Is there any way I could make tea without poisoning myself?
Yes. So sassafras has a concern that I'll share with you that it seems you've heard of. So about 50 or 60 years ago, a study was done where they fed rats a whole bunch of an essential oil called safrol, which is the essential oil that's in the sassafras root bark that is partially responsible for the root beer flavor in that root bark. And some of those rats got cancer, and so the Food and Drug Administration said, okay, that's it. We're going to ban safrol-containing sassafras products from the food supply. And that ban is still in effect. But all that study did was show that if you feed a whole bunch of safrol to rats, some of those rats got cancer. I and other people I know that have looked into this haven't found any anecdotal evidence that humans get cancer from sassafras, because although our metabolisms are similar to rats, they're not the same. So even so, though, if it's something that you're worried about, like maybe there's something to it, I encourage you to refrain from using the sassafras root if it makes you uncomfortable. In fact, when I teach my classes, I encourage people to not push the envelope and not eat a plant, for example, where they're concerned about, did I pick the right thing, or is the area clean where I harvested it? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, so I'm not going to eat it.
Err on the side of caution.
Yeah, I think that's sensible.
Yeah. So what could she do with the sassafras?
Okay. So I have made sassafras tea. It's very tasty. And in my book, I've got a recipe for sassafras candy, which is like root beer barrels that you used to buy at the penny candy store, only even better because there's little bits of root bark embedded in the candy. I leave it up to individual people to decide if they want to use the plant or not. But I've used it, and certainly over many thousands of years, it's been used by many people.
So to make a tea, what would she have to do?
Oh, you just can peel the root bark. That's where the flavor is. And just steep it in hot water for a few minutes till you get the desired flavor. And you can usually reuse the root bark. There's one other edible part on sassafras where the safrol isn't an issue, and that's the young leaves. And young sassafras leaves are what filet powder is made from. And so you just gather the leaves in the spring when they're about an inch in size, and you spread them out in a cookie sheet and dry them thoroughly, and then just pulverize the dried leaves, put it in a little salt or pepper shaker, and add it to your food near the end to flavor and thicken it.
Wow. Janet, you have to let us know what you think if you try that tea.
Well, yeah, I was thinking more, or not the root, but the leaves, because I have great quantities. And you know, my horse eats huge amounts and hasn't poisoned himself yet.
Well, unfortunately, there isn't 100% overlap between what people can eat and what animals can eat. So we can't rely on them to figure out whether something's edible or not. For example, poison ivy berries are eaten by a lot of bird species. So you can't emulate the birds and eat poison ivy berries. That would not be a good idea.
All right. Jenna, thanks for calling. Peter is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. I was calling about watercress. Is it available here in the local area, and how does it grow?
So watercress has that name because it's usually the bottoms of it are growing in water, and then the tops stick out of the water. And it is available. I know of a patch in Martha's Vineyard that the word has gotten out, and it's very popular, and people pick it. And once again, you know, I encourage people to use some forbearance and restraint when gathering from the wild to make sure that there's enough to for the plants to do their natural functions and enough for to share with other foragers. But anyway, So the other concern about watercress is that it doesn't have any trouble growing in water that's been oversupplied with nutrients, let's say the drainage from a livestock operation. And there could be some flukes or other things you would not want to expose yourself to by eating the watercress. So I encourage people to just use the portion of the plant that's above the water. And maybe if you're not quite sure that its area is safe, you might want to cook it, and that will make it safer to eat.
Okay. Peter, thanks for the call. You've written Juneberry pie is often described by people as the best pie they've ever eaten. Juneberry is also known as the common name shad bush. Is that right? So when do the berries arrive, and how would you describe their taste?
Well, it's called Juneberry, I think.
Because it's June?
Yes, although the name probably comes from further south, like from Pennsylvania. So in Yul Gibbon's book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, he uses the word Juneberry. In some parts of New England, it might be better called Julyberry because it doesn't really ripen until then. And that might be true on Cape Cod, too. Mm-hmm. So Cape Cod, I've had some of the most delicious, I'll call them shadbush berries, or it's the genus Amelanchier. So some most delicious shadbush I ever had was way out in the Outer Cape. Out in Truro, where the plants were only about 3 feet tall, and the berries are ripe in July, and they're delicious. They're like a cross between cherries and almonds.
Mm. And in our region, the Juneberry is susceptible to cedar apple rust fungus. So how does the fungus impact the plant, and is there a way to get rid of it?
Well, that I don't know. It doesn't seem to be as bad every year. Some years it can afflict just about all the fruit, and other years it doesn't seem to be bad, and I'm not quite sure why that is. It probably has to do with moisture at the wrong time for spreading the spores, the fungus. So it's very obvious when the fruit has been afflicted by this because it doesn't look edible at all. You wouldn't want to put it in your mouth, and it wouldn't taste good anyway. You can avoid it.
Yeah. And you mentioned Yul Gibbons, and it's so funny you say that. I think I told you this before we went on the air yesterday. Like, looking through all your stuff reminded me of Yul Gibbons. And so, of course, some of the younger people in the news were like, who's Yul Gibbons? But remember, we used to do the grape nut commercials.
Right. And tastes like wild hickory nuts.
Yeah. What was it? Ever eat a pine tree? Most parts are edible. Yeah.
He was ahead
of his time. Huh?
He was ridiculed for that commercial.
Yes, I know.
Gibbons sold out.
All right. So the Northeast has a number of different habitats, and within each habitat, a number of different native species that are edible. If we focus on the Cape and Islands region, most of our common habitats would include the beach,
right,
the marsh,
right,
riparian or the along river banks,
right,
woodland with the scrub and pine and oak, and suburbia.
yes, there's certainly, we were talking about chickweed before. Sometimes your backyard is the best and easiest place to look for wild edibles, like the weeds in your vegetable garden. So, and that would include, for example, lamb's quarters, which is a wild spinach, which actually has more vitamins than spinach. And then as the summer heat comes on, purslane.
Oh, purslane. That's right. Tons of that. We have tons of that.
Right,
yeah.
Which is edible raw. It's edible cooked. It's high in omega-3 fatty acids.
That's
high
good in a
iron.
Salad, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. So, but if I were thinking about the wilder habitats in Cape Cod, if Cape Cod has two iconic wild edibles, arguably they are the cranberry and the beach plum.
Mm-hmm.
And I would trust that people would know how to recognize a cranberry and know that there are some wild or abandoned bogs in the Cape where you can pick your own wild cranberries, although it's important to support the cranberry industry.
Right.
It is fun to gather your own wild cranberries. But beach plums, the story I usually hear about beach plums, I can never find them, or somebody picked them before I did, or I never tell people where my beach plums
are. That's right.
So,
yeah.
So this is a plant I am very happily growing from seed, and it is very easy. So when I gather beach plums, I save every little pit from inside the fruit, and then I grow a tree from it, and I'm busily planting more in the landscape just to make, literally and figuratively, make the pie bigger so that there's more fruit for all of us.
And most people will use them to make beach plum jelly, but you actually brought, this is beach plum something, right?
Yes, so that's a beach plum rugelach. So it's a Central European dessert. It's basically using the beach plum as a filling.
Mm.
And so I took a sour cherry rugelach recipe and I adapted it for beach plums.
Mm, that's good too. That lots of pastry you brought here this morning.
Well, sure. It's a fun way to use wild edibles. Although I'll have to say that in order to make the beach plum rugelach, you have to make the beach plum jam first because that is one of the filling ingredients
it
in
does
there.
Sort of have almost like a cherry little bit of flavor to it, doesn't it?
Well, beach plums and cherries are related.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Russ Cohen, who has been gathering, eating, and teaching people about wild edible plants for decades. He's the author of Wild Plants I Have Known and Eaten. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Anna Maria is calling from Marston's Mills. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. This is Anna Maria, and I'm calling about burdock.
Okay.
And it's an edible plant.
Yes, it's a wonderful edible plant. Is it something that you've eaten?
Well, I tried to, and it wasn't very successful. I didn't have any directions.
Oh, all right. Well, I will tell you what to do. So burdock is a biennial, which means it has a two-year life cycle. So the first year, you see these tremendously large leaves that look a lot like rhubarb leaves, and they go down to this big beige taproot. Then the plant witches over, and then the second year it produces a flower stalk and flowers and blooms and goes to seed and dies. That's the life cycle for a burdock. So the most well-known edible part on a burdock is the root, and you harvest it between the first and second growing season. So you could get it now as soon as the vegetation is showing and you see where it is. The challenging part about burdock roots is digging them up because they'll break on you if you try to yank on them. So you have to dig them out, and it's a lot of work. But if you did and you wash them off and you slice them crosswise and boil them in salted water for about 15 minutes, it tastes like a starchy artichoke.
Hmm.
But what I do is I eat the developing flower stalks of the second-year plants. They're a lot easier to gather. You prepare them the same way. It only takes about 5 minutes of cooking, and they're really yummy, just plain or incorporated into different dishes.
All right. Anna Marie, good luck with that. One of the things we were talking about, beach plums, a common thing is, where do we find them when they go? They're all gone. How do you find them?
Yeah. So I'm giving a talk tonight in Falmouth at the 300 Committee in the Salt Pond Aries Bird Sanctuaries are sponsoring. And when the beach plum photo comes up, the first thing I do is show people beach plums blooming, because that's when they stand out against the drabber colors of the landscape. So this is, in the dunes before everything greens up, the beach plum bushes are blooming their guts out, and they're very easily spotted. And that's when you see where they are, remember where they are, and then go back. And the advice I give is Labor Day weekend is a reliable time to find beach plums. Sometimes early, sometimes later, but always on Labor Day weekend you can find them. Because when the fruit is ripe, it's purple, and purple is a hard color to see from a distance. So it's good to it's good to already know where the beach plums are.
Yeah, you say remember. I would say write it down.
Yes. Yeah.
Because you won't remember. Right. Chapter 5 of your book is Ground Nuts. The pilgrims wouldn't have progressed without it. So Native Americans must have introduced the Europeans to many edible native plants. Was that the case with the groundnuts?
Well, the story as I hear it is that when the Pilgrims arrived in Plymouth, they occupied a Native American encampment that had been abandoned several years earlier, I think, because of disease. And so they had some food left over on the boat that they came over with, but it wasn't enough to keep them going. And so so I believe it was none other than Miles Standish found a cache of groundnuts that the Native Americans had set aside in this encampment. And they found that and they ate those. And it was very important supplemental food supply to help them survive that first harsh winter of 1620-21.
If people are interested in cultivating native species in their gardens, are there particular species that might do better than other? For example, the groundnut?
Well, groundnut's easy to grow from the tubers or the seeds, the little beans. I've done it both ways. One fun plant to try and grow in Cape Cod is the wild strawberry, and because it loves sandy soil, and anybody that has any kind of a lawn or a mowed area can accommodate wild strawberry. So it grows very easily from seed. One place I know you can get the seed is from a nonprofit organization called the Wild Seed Project, which is up in Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm. That's where I get my seed from. And I sow it indoors to give it a head start, but you could sow it outside this time of year. It would be do fine. And just sprinkle a few seeds in a little pot and just let it grow. And then when the plants are big enough, transplant it into your yard. And it's a delightful little plant to have there. It doesn't mind getting mowed or stepped on.
And we like those hardy little plants. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment, question, or thoughts on this morning's program, 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have one other little sample that you brought. So what is this?
Okay, so that's a black walnut honey square. So black walnuts are in season in October, but I gather a bunch of the nuts, and they keep fine inside their shell for at least a year until you want to use them, and then you crack them open, and then you make things from them.
I can taste the honey in this. Do you use like a local honey when you do
Sure, that? Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of good local honeys available.
And these are black walnuts, you said?
Yes.
We don't have black walnuts around here, do we?
Yeah, they grow in the Cape.
We do?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So as you mentioned, in your retirement, you've taken to cultivating and planting these native species. And you've got, what'd you say, about, there's 170 and you have about 60 of them. So how do you, how do you decide on which to try and grow? I mean, is it easiest?
Well, some are really easy. Like a really fun plant that grows in the Cape and Islands that I've been growing from seed is called the sweet goldenrod. This is Solidago odora. It's a licorice-flavored goldenrod. It's one of the plants that the American colonists turned to make tea from when they were boycotting the British tea during the Revolutionary War era. And so you just steep the leaves and the flowers in hot water for a few minutes, and you get this licorice-flavored drink. And when I was on a field trip in Falmouth last September, I saw a whole bunch of sweet goldenrod. So I know you have it here. I've seen it out on Monomoy Island. I've seen it underneath power lines in Martha's Vineyard. So you definitely have it here. And so you can gather the seeds in the fall and then just sow them whenever you want. And they'll start growing within 2 or 3 weeks after you sow them.
So how do you gather seeds, and how do you find these where to plant them? You go, you ask permission. You go and say,
yes.
Hey, can I do this?
Yes.
Right?
So, for example, for my sweet goldenrod seed, I found a very nice patch of them underneath some power lines and some conservation land in Braintree, south of Boston. So I contacted the local conservation agent and told her what I was doing, and she said, sure, please feel free to gather the seeds to propagate plants from the seed.
And then when you plant them, other than your own area, you ask permission for that as well?
Oh, yeah. I'm only doing cooperative partnerships with groups. I'm not doing any guerrilla planting. So everyone that I do planting with has invited me and actually is very enthusiastic about what I'm doing to have the new plants. So one of the sites in the Cape where I've done some planting is the Long Pasture Audubon Sanctuary in Barnstable. And I've supplemented the native and non-native edibles that are already present on that property with additional native edibles from my nursery.
What about wintergreen?
Yes. So wintergreen has the same flavor that was in the black birch tea that you drank earlier today.
I love wintergreen.
And so now the best leaves to use to make the tea from the wintergreen aren't out yet. They'll be out in mid to late spring in the very, very early summer. And those of you that are familiar with the plant know that the fresh young growth of the plant, the leaves are soft and they have kind of a reddish green color, almost orange. And I found out several years ago that orange Pekoe tea, just regular Camellia sinensis. So orange Pekoe isn't a variety of tea. It's actually the stage in the life of a tea leaf.
Hmm.
And the wintergreen leaves go through that same stage. And so the orange Pekoe wintergreen leaves make the best tea. It's the strongest flavor, mildest, less bitterness.
I guess I mentioned this when I was a kid. I played in the woods a lot, and we would chew on the leaves of the wintergreen.
Yes.
And it almost has that like flavor like tea berry gum.
That's right.
Yeah, and we used to chew that all the time. I don't know how we discovered that. Maybe my grandfather showed us or something. But and they had sometimes little berries.
Yeah, so
the berries seem to be harder to find than the leaves. Yeah,
yeah. It seems to be, you know, varies from patch to patch. I've seen lots of wintergreen plants with no berries on them at all, and I've seen other wintergreen patches with hundreds of berries. And the berries are edible too. They're not that sweet, but they do have the wintergreen flavor.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about recipes for some of these native species that you include in your book. The maple hickory nut pie. We can't find the shagbark hickory tree in our region. So what would we maybe use here that we could
Right. So some
instead.
Of the stuff we already talked about. So the milkweed egg puff with milkweed and the wild green spanakopita with the stinging nettle.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Juneberry chapter, I've got two recipes. So Juneberry muffins. So you could use the fresh fruit, the dried fruit, or the frozen fruit in the muffin recipe. It all works fine. And
why don't we find the Juneberries? Like, I've never heard of them. I mean, we don't see them in the markets or anything, right?
Right. Well, a lot of wild food isn't sold commercially because it doesn't meet the requirements that commercial supermarkets have. For example, it might not have a long shelf life, or sometimes plants don't ripen uniformly all at the same time, and so you have to revisit and that's pretty common with wild crops. It's that they'll ripen over a period of several weeks. So that means requires several visits to the shad bush to, you know, go and pick again. And in the meantime, for plants that are native, that have values to animals, that gives them plenty of opportunities to visit those plants and eat too.
You have a cookie recipe that uses barberry, but there are two kinds of barberry species in New England. One is invasive and the other native. Does it matter which one you
use?
Well,
actually, there's the Japanese barberry and what's called the European barberry. And the Japanese barberry is the one that is really, really bad news ecologically. It's very disruptive. One of especially where you're from in Connecticut, it can form these monocultures as an understory species in hardwoods, basically because the deer have eaten everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave the barberry behind. And there's a possible connection between barberries and white-footed mice, which are the hosts for the Lyme disease bacterium. And so stuff like that. So anyway, the European barberry, even though it's also called the common barberry, is actually much less common than the Japanese barberry. And the Japanese barberry berries are not poisonous, but they don't taste good. But the European barberries taste very good, and they make what my wife and I consider to be the best jelly there is.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about taste for a minute, because, you know, when you're out there and you're going, that looks interesting. I might like to taste it, but I don't know. Should I nibble on that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you certainly don't want to put anything in your mouth that just by the contact with your skin would cause a problem, like a raw stinging nettle or poison ivy or poison sumac or plants like that, where just, you know, the contact dermatitis is bad news. But in general, you have to ingest a poison to have it really poison you. So I don't make a practice of this, and I would not do it with any mushrooms, but with wild berries, for example, I don't know of any berry that grows in this area that's delicious and poisonous. And so if you're pretty sure that a berry is edible and just a very quick taste would confirm if you've got the right thing or not, you can put it briefly in your mouth and taste it. And if it tastes bad, spit it out. And the worst that could happen is that you'd feel nauseous for a little while, and that's probably because you scared yourself to death more than anything.
And we probably should talk about mushrooms for a minute. Mushrooms are a whole different category in themselves.
Right. So I am going to talk about mushrooms in my slideshow tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And what I say about mushrooms is that the risk of making a mistake with mushrooms is potentially much more significant than for plants, because unfortunately the most lethal mushrooms, and we have at least a dozen species that fall into that category here in New England, there's nothing from the flavor whatsoever that gives you any advance warning to worry about. So you could have this delicious mushroom meal one day and be dead several days later from liver and or kidney failure. So Having said that, you can arrange all the mushroom species on a line and cluster to one end of those species that are virtually impossible to confuse with anything poisonous versus those at the other end that even the experts can't tell apart. And as long as you stay at the safe end of the line and you gradually work it out as you gain experience and confidence, that's how you stay out of trouble.
Yeah, and there's plenty of walks and experts in the mushrooms who you can learn from, would probably be the best way.
Yeah, that's how I learned. I learned from other people. It's better than learning just from books.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little about ginseng for a second. Do we have that on the Cape? I don't know.
I don't actually know. I have seen it in Massachusetts. It's not considered an edible plant. It's just a medicinal plant. It has a cousin called dwarf ginseng that I have eaten that has a little spherical root to it that's like a wooden marble. And those are fun to eat. They're very starchy. But that's a native species, and so it is important to make sure there's a lot of it before you dig up any.
When I lived in Vermont, my neighbor used to go out and dig up ginseng, and he would pay for his oil with them. I mean, it was like there's a big market for it. But he was very funny because he wasn't telling anybody where he was finding that, right? That's like the secret spots, right?
Right. Yeah, so that has me a little concerned when wild plants become articles of commerce, because I think it can trigger unscrupulous, irresponsible people to
taking
go into
too
the
much,
woods.
Yeah,
you know, when you start looking at plants as dollar signs, I think it changes your relationship with the plants. Mm. So that's not why I teach my wild food things, is for people to cash in on the wild foods craze. It's just for them to be able to connect to nature directly. No intermediary. I'm not teaching them how to read a fancy restaurant menu better. I'm teaching them how to connect to nature by finding these plants themselves and nibbling on it directly, because I think that's the real fun of foraging, is the being outside
and discovering these recipes, all this yummy stuff you brought in. I have to say, I like this. What was this called again?
The black walnut honey squares.
That is my favorite.
Oh, all right.
I like them all, but
okay.
That was really, really, really
very
good.
Easy to make.
Yeah. Oh, really? I'll have to check that recipe out. So what are your favorite wild greens for salads or for cooking?
Well, once again, I would answer that by saying it depends on the time of the year on what's available. So I think purslane is really good. And the nice thing about purslane is you can put the purslane leaves in a gazpacho, and you don't even have to make the gazpacho. You could go to the store and just buy that regular chunky gazpacho, then go out to your yard, pick a few purslane leaves, and just throw them into the gazpacho, and the texture of the purslane leaves works really well in a gazpacho.
Mm, I hadn't thought about that. That's a good... Right. Although the gazpacho isn't very hard to make.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah,
good.
No, it's pretty easy.
Yeah,
yeah,
good.
Yeah. And then do you have a favorite time of year when you're out and about looking for things?
I'm looking all the time because there's important little clues that nature can give you about foraging opportunities, even when things aren't in season. For example, black raspberry, which I'm going to talk about in my show tonight. In the off season, it's easier to spot than during when the fruit is ripe, because during the off season, the canes turn purple. Mm-hmm. And so you'd be out walking your dog, cross country skiing, and you look way off in the edge of the field and you'd see these purpley thorny canes. Those are black raspberries. So remember where they are, or in your case,
write it down.
And then go back in June, early July, and look for the fruit.
Yeah,
so,
sometimes you think you remember and you're searching and searching, and why can't I find it?
That's
so true.
Russ
Cohen is the author of Wild Plants I Have Known and Eaten. He'll be speaking at the Falmouth Historical Society tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll post more information about his talk, his book, and a list of wild plants native to the Northeast at our website, capeandislands.org. Russ, thanks for coming. Thanks for bringing all these goodies with you this morning. I really enjoyed the hour.
You're
thanks
most
for being
welcome.
Here.
It's been great.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.